Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. This is a retrospective show from the days before Disrespect was posted on the web. Full disclosure, I was in the ODSP the last month and submitted twice a community startup on medical grounds. Twice, the worker didn't even look at the application. Once, the worker was told if anybody ever laughs at an applicant because of their disability, they won't be working here anymore. It didn't change the second experience. We take you back to about 2004 now to see how the experience remains unchanged at ODSP with activist Ron Payne. Ron Payne's come to us at Disrespect again today. We remember your last interview on welfare action, Ron. It's set up and it's start. I understand you want to talk to us today about the application process for Ontario Disability Support and a particular example that came your way when you were working as an information provider with a client. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's got it bang on, Jeff, talking about the process, the application process. As you know, when the province came into power back in 1996, they had a contract with a company called Accucenture. It was Anderson Consulting at the time, and everything just got bogged down in the application process for people with disabilities. A lot of people got cut off, and it's very difficult for people to get on now. Like I said last time, I think I mentioned that doctors are sick and tired of filling out reports because they're just not being used. Their opinion isn't being used in the process of whether a person is classified as being disabled or not. And just recently, we came across a young lady who was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer. She wasn't very healthy, and she wanted to get her story out. And we were doing some taping interviews of people that were having exceptional problems with disabilities and the system a couple of months ago through one of the projects that the SPRC, I believe, was running.
That's the Social Planning and Research
Council. Sure. And for the homelessness, for one of the homelessness forums that we were preparing a report for one of the homelessness forums that they were holding. And this lady came to we had it at one of the halls, and everybody came to tell their horror story. And this lady made the effort to come after being diagnosed with terminal cancer and waiting over a year for her disability benefits. She came to tell the public how difficult it is, and here she is dying of cancer and still all the problems with the process.
I understand you're going to leave your clients anonymous to respect their dignity.
Certainly, yeah, certainly. She came to our little get-together to tape record her problems, and she was simply too ill to stay. She got there. By the time we got everybody sat down, she was just too ill and had to go home. But she made the effort. She wanted to get her word out. She was just simply too sick to do that. And at that time, she had waited over a year for her disability benefits. Why did it take so long? Well, because it always takes a long time. And this is an exceptional, but it's not that exceptional. I think I mentioned last time I was on about missing documents, how the ODSP and welfare, the OW, Ontario Works, misplaces documents, and it's horrendous. Well, this lady originally applied, and Ontario Works lost her original application form.
So despite the fact she's terminally ill, Ontario Works doesn't treat her any different from somebody pretending that they want work and running away from a job.
They certainly don't seem to discriminate when they choose to lose documents on who they're going to lose documents on behalf
of. Gotcha.
But this poor lady, sick as she is, she redid the application process and had the doctor fill out all the reports and gave it to welfare, and welfare lost the medical reports. So she
the originals.
The original medical reports. So that put the process back 6 months. She had to go back to the doctor, the specialist, make all the appointments, go back to the doctors, sign the forms, resubmit all the documents.
And while she's dying.
While she's dying. And this slowed her process down 6 months. The doctor's office even lost her file. So that didn't help. At the very beginning that they lost her file, it was even a long time for her to get the documentation into welfare after they lost the first set. But anyway, the finally after a year, and I think it was a year and 2 months, a year and 3 months, she finally was accepted as being disabled. They issued her check. Welfare took their portion out.
Did you play a role in this?
No, we just came onto the scene, right? Well, we a small role, but not we didn't advocate on her behalf. We were just helping her along, organizing, explain to her what to do with the money, because when you get your money from ODSP, they classify that as an income, so you'd have to live off that unless you know what your rights are and spend that money appropriately, like to benefit your family unit or benefit yourself. They'll classify it as income, and you wouldn't be eligible for benefits after they reimbursed you. So this lady received, I think she received $3,800 after all was said and done, and she received her first check. Well, that was 4 days ago. She died, and they're burying her as we speak.
She received her first check, and she had 4 days to spend it.
4 days, yeah, and she died. The process was just so long, and she died miserably. She died in pain. She died in agony. She died poor. She died hungry. She died sick. And there
it's
was
almost as if she waited for her damn check to die.
You could just about think that. But what bothers me the very most is I just can't see, and I can't bring myself to see anybody in that system that gives a damn about it. I just don't see it.
No, that's certainly an extreme case.
Sure.
Well, do you think they hastened her death with poverty and anxiety and problems with the doctor and lack of respect for her in front of the doctor, encouraging, in fact, the doctor, if he were so inclined to treat her with a little less than the dignity that people would normally receive in that situation?
Well, I certainly...
By example.
I certainly think that most people that are disabled know the importance of eating a nutritious meal, eating nutritiously.
For your immune system, and your health.
Certainly, certainly. And people on Ontario Works aren't eating nutritiously, and they're getting sick because of it, and the doctor's visits are way up. For the people that know how important it is and have experienced when you're not eating nutritiously, how weak you are, how your mind isn't working up to par, how things just aren't your body just isn't functioning up to peak. And simply eating a meal can mean so much to your body. I've experienced it myself on waiting for disability benefits. Just having a decent meal, how perky it makes you, how it gives you energy.
Now, you spoke about her first check. Was this her first OW check or her
disability check, yeah.
So she was eating on an OW budget. And, of course,
sure.
She didn't have access to the special dietary benefits that they allow.
No, she didn't know. We just gave her that information when we found out, when we met her.
Yeah, so the people who knew she was dying and knew that nutrition might prolong her life didn't give her that information.
No, well, that's, your listeners that listened last time, that's the big secret. The big secret is for OW and ODSP not to inform people of what they're entitled to. That's the big secret in Ontario. That's why I'm coming on your show, to hopefully with your show and your permission and my speaking out, people will learn that there's a lot of benefits that you're entitled to, and it's just a matter of accessing them. And that's still very difficult to access them. If you don't go to the right person, you won't find out about it.
Well, as you know, you have more than our permission. You have our encouragement. Who is the right person to go to if you want to find out about these things? And who? What are the plans to improve access to these things? And make more people aware of what they're entitled to but not being told about.
there are different benefits that people can access that they're just not aware of. Are your listeners eating properly? Maybe are they weak in some areas? Maybe there's things they just don't know about, and I suggest there probably is. And, of course, you know, when you do this kind of work for long enough, you just see how bizarre the whole system is, and that's the definitive word for it. It's bizarre. It makes no sense whatsoever. If these governments are out to help people and help people get well, we certainly don't see it.
There must be ongoing costs on this, too, and I know you don't get involved directly in that, but, I mean, if a government doesn't help someone improve their health, they're paying their drug and prescription costs, so any symptoms that would have evolved from being badly treated at the outset of the application would devolve further on into increased costs for the government that's footing the bill once somebody gets accepted. And, of course, if that person's health deteriorates even further, then there are costs like assistive devices and long-term care and probably even palliative care and hospital costs would come up into the picture if the health deteriorated fast enough. It doesn't seem a very money-wise step for a supposedly fiscally conservative government to take. A government that's supposed to be counting its pennies instead seems to be looking more closely at its immediate cash flow, more like a corporation taking profits than a government in the public interest or even in its own interest of limiting long-term costs to themselves, never mind to the people who that you're treating.
Well, I certainly think you should volunteer for Welfare Action because it certainly seems you know what you're talking about. What you're saying is exactly the way it is. It's simply a money grab for Accenture. If you're talking dollars and cents for the government, if they cut somebody off benefits and they become homeless, I guess the taxpayers and the provincial government pays that. But if you look at what you're talking about, medical expenses, well, who ultimately pays medical expenses? Does that not come from the federal government? If the provincial government wants to reinvest in a different area like corporations, where are they going to get that money from? They're not going to take it away from a program that they fund anyway. They're going to get it from the federal government, aren't they?
Right.
They're going to ignore one section or one class of people and promote a different class of people so they get the federal dollars in. For the medical, for people on disabilities that are getting sick, do they really care? They don't fund that. The money comes from the federal.
So you're saying federal dollars or whatever they are, they're 20-cent dollars for the provincial
sure.
government, and they'd rather you go to the hospital than
sure.
that you get
well,
better on
I'm
their
sure
tab.
You'd never find a politician admitting that, but why have we had the problems medically in the last 6 years? The top two issues on the agenda right now is education and medical.
But if you're saying medical dollars are whatever, 20-cent dollars, or I don't know what the sharing ratio is, it would seem they would prefer to shunt things off and medicalize disability as something that should be treated for symptoms rather than something that should be addressed as a health problem or even people attempt to adapt to it or anything to live with it, to go back to work with it, to have some dignity, to live a life, extend their lives, extend their time of dignity even with a degenerative disability. Is that correct? Am
sure.
I reading
no,
you right?
Yeah. You're bang on. You're bang on. What you're saying is exactly right.
While we're at it, are there any other institutions, provincial or otherwise, I mean, that could address such a thing? I mean, we have legal clinics. Can they help these people?
Yeah.
Any help?
You know, the clinics, it's hard. I mean, you know, they're there, they're working. Can you complain about the clinics? Well, if there's a complaint, sure, and I don't mind. The clinics are, in my view, and I'm sure they're going to be mad at me, but they're very, very busy. They're overworked because of the new ODSP legislation. It seems their main work now is dealing with the tribunal and these lengthy applications. And of course, as we all know, the percentages, the majority of them aren't being accepted. So there's another appeal procedure after that.
So their work is incident focused rather than policy focused or towards making an example of a string of related incidents.
Yeah, no. If you have more than one incident, and it's to do with OW and the tribunal, I'd certainly suggest if a clinic's not helping you or you're not satisfied at all, go find yourself and spend the time to find a lawyer that you're happy with. It's very, very important to find that lawyer that's going to look after your best interest and be attentive and pay attention and answer your questions and answer your calls. It's extremely important when you hire a lawyer to hire one that you'll be happy with.
Okay. Do we have any help from the Ontario Human Rights Commission? I mean, the provincial government passed an Ontarians with Disabilities Act. Regrettably, there's nothing in it for compensation, whether you survive your application to disability benefits or you die on the day of your first check. Even to bury you, there really isn't any money coming from the Ontarians with Disabilities Act for your indignity, let alone for your actual financial losses or lost opportunities in the future, or even your lost future in its entirety for the lady who died. But the Ontario Human Rights Commission, which is charged with administering this act, have they been any help in addressing this issue? Very briefly.
I would have to say I just don't know that. I've been at this for 2 years, and there hasn't been a situation that you could get and have them help you with that doesn't take 2 years. They're simply so bogged down with their other work that the process is null and void because of the length of time it takes to go through that process, in my opinion.
Okay. Ron, was there anything you want to add?
Thanks for having me. I mean, this is so important to get the word out, and your show simply gives us that opportunity, and we appreciate it very much.
Hey, we appreciate you coming on.
Thanks.
We'll have you back.
A little musical relief now. Lucy Kaplansky, Hole in My Head.
Just say we will and then don't instead. Wild goose chase, you gonna take me, boy, on a wild goose chase. You gonna take me, boy, on a wild goose chase. You better find somebody to take my place. You took my
Before we get into Disrespect's weekly review of the news, we'd like to notify you that CFMU is Hamilton's Radio Station of the Year. We won Radio Station of the Year at the 2010 Hamilton Music Industry Awards. CFMU also won this award in 2004, 2005, and 2007. And now for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the articles that we read to you. These are summations or condensations of the articles that we find in the newspapers that we read the names of on the broadcast. Britain to force welfare recipients to seek work. PM risks social discord with plan targeting perpetually unemployed. Prime Minister David Cameron's government announced sweeping plans to change the lives of 5 million people dependent on government payments in an effort to push hundreds of thousands of people into the workforce. In a week when deficit-slashing efforts led to Britain's first acts of rioting after university tuition fee increases were announced, and after France was paralyzed for weeks for a raise in its retirement age, Mr. Cameron risked even more discord with plans to force all welfare and unemployment recipients to seek work, even unpaid volunteer work, or to risk losing their benefits. Through a work program whose name evokes Victorian efforts at reform, the perpetually dependent would be trained to do jobs, however minimal, or risk losing their checks. An estimated 2 million children, mostly descendants of the old industrial working class, grow up in households in which nobody has ever worked. Britain suffers from very high levels of poverty and intergenerational welfare dependency to an extent not seen in other European countries or in Canada. Unemployment benefits, together with housing and disability benefits, cost Britain $87 billion plus $3 to $5 billion in administration costs each year. Governments have tried and failed to make reforms for 30 years. Critics said this week that Mr. Duncan Smith faces two fundamental problems. First, he is launching a vast welfare-to-work scheme during a period of layoffs when there are unlikely to be jobs in the deprived regions where people will be losing their benefits. Second, the root of Britain's unique welfare dependency problem is the large number of people classified as not in education, employment, or training, or NEETs, N-E-E-T-S, most of whom dropped out of secondary school at 16. Very few jobs exist for such people, and fixing this would require big expenditures in the education system at a moment when the government is cutting back. Given that most economists do not expect the labor force to grow significantly as a result, and some fear the cuts would trigger a downturn, there is a chance that the whole exercise could end up costing the government more money. That from the Globe and Mail, Doug Saunders in London. Study finds women's heart attack risk doubled by job strain. Women with high levels of job strain have a significantly higher risk of suffering a heart attack or other adverse cardiovascular event compared to those who report less stressful work lives, a major study has found. Researchers who presented their findings Monday at the annual meeting of the American Heart Association in Chicago found an overall 40% increased risk for heart attack, stroke, the need for invasive bypass surgery, and death from cardiovascular disease. Broken down, the risk of heart attack was almost 88% higher in women with sustained on-the-job stress, while the risk of bypass surgery or procedures to open up blocked coronary arteries was about 43% higher. The study also found that the fear of losing one's job was linked to risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol levels, and excess body weight. But job insecurity did not translate into a higher risk of heart attacks and other cardiovascular conditions. The findings mirror those of a Danish study published earlier this year, said Dr. Andrew Pipe, chief of prevention and rehabilitation at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute, noting that a similar finding about job strain has also been identified in males. That in the Toronto Star, Canadian Press, Cheryl Ublacher. Money, a hurdle to BC Native Education Board. An effort to build a First Nations Education Board in British Columbia is in its final stages. But the missing ingredient needed to launch the First Nations Education Steering Committee is money. Education funding is a decades-old bone of contention between the federal government and Native peoples. Estimates put a disparity at an average of 20% less per First Nations pupil in investment. There's also a gap in academic achievement. The proportion of Aboriginal youth aged 20 to 24 living on reserve who have not completed high school has climbed to 61%, according to the 2006 census. The Education Group are hopeful that an announcement on funding will come by December 12th, which will mark the fourth anniversary of the passing of the federal legislation that was the First Nations Education Steering Committee's first major victory. Representatives from the group were in Ottawa this week meeting with politicians soliciting their support. If the members of the First Nations Educational Steering Committee do manage to secure a funding model for First Nations students that parallels the provincial system, it will be a big, big breakthrough, said Michael Mendelson, senior scholar at the Caledon Institute of Social Policy. There are about 6,000 students in 130 First Nations schools in BC, and most have been working closely with the First Nations Education Steering Committee. That by Kate Hammer, education reporter in the Globe and Mail, Thursday, November 18th. Disabled vets to get higher awards. The substantial improvements to veterans' benefits proposed by the Conservative government aim to do more than aid those injured in body or mind while fighting in Afghanistan. The new legislation offers a $2 billion solution to the complaints of aggrieved veterans of the Afghan conflict. Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn revealed proposed legislative changes that would substantially improve payments to those seriously injured in the line of duty. Those who could not work because of their injuries would receive a minimum of $40,000 a year in government support under proposed changes to the 2006 new Veterans Charter. In addition, injured veterans who are receiving the lump sum disability award may, if they prefer, receive it instead as an annual payment over as many years as they choose. This is a good second chapter to the original new Veterans Charter, which came into effect 4 years ago, said Brad White, Dominion Secretary for the Royal Canadian Legion. But there is more that needs to be done. NDP MP Peter Stopher, who has been a harsh critic of the Tory approach to meeting the needs of veterans, gave the legislation a grudging C-. For Mr. Stopher and Mr. White, the next step would be increasing the maximum disability award payment from $276,000 to somewhere around $330,000, which Mr. White said is closer to the amount courts typically award to severely disabled workers. Thus far, Veterans Affairs Canada has assisted 2,900 veterans returning from Afghanistan. It's true that we have to be more efficient with our veterans, especially those veterans who are coming back from Afghanistan, acknowledged Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn. And that by John Ibbotson in Ottawa in the Globe and Mail. And in a story about an old guest of the show, Veterans Advocate settles over leaked files. Brouillé relieved by Norma Greenaway. Saying he is close to closing a disturbing chapter in his life, veteran Sean Brouillé has settled his $400,000 lawsuit against the federal government over abuse of his personal and financial files. "My wife and I are relieved that after 5 years of despair, we have taken back ownership of our lives," Mr. Brouillé said in a statement. The out-of-court settlement comes after Mr. Brouillé accepted a rare government apology for the abuse of his personal medical and financial files by officials in the Veterans Affairs Department. The rush to come to terms with Mr. Brouillé came after Canada's Privacy Commissioner ruled last month there had been an alarming dissemination of the 46-year-old retired Air Force intelligence officer's files, including psychiatric reports sent to cabinet ministers by Veterans Affairs officials who had no right or need to see them. Mr. Brouillé is a Gulf War veteran who suffered post-traumatic stress disorder and discovered last year that abuse of his files began after he became a public advocate for veterans, criticizing the benefits system at Veterans Affairs. Quote, "I was very troubled to learn that personal information concerning you was shared among public servants who had no need for this information to do their work," read Mr. Blackburn's apology. "I recognize this information sharing has caused you needless suffering and anxiety, and for that, the government and I am truly sorry." Post Media News in the National Post by Norma Greenaway. Rise in mentally ill offenders swamping prisons and hospitals. A steep increase in mentally ill offenders is flooding prisons and psychiatric institutions, confounding officials whose job it is to find accommodation and treatment for them. In illustration of the problem, the Ontario Review Board, a provincial body responsible for offenders found not criminally responsible for committing offenses, had more than 1,500 patients under its purview last year, a fourfold increase from 1992. Almost 300 offenders are added annually, dwarfing the number who are released. The outlook is equally grim in the prison system. Since 2004, the total number of mentally disordered inmates in Ontario jails increased by 5.7%, said Steve Small, Assistant Deputy Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services. I've been around for 30 years, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Just over 18% of the 8,948 inmates behind bars in the province last June had a psychiatric disorder. Of 575 female offenders, 31% were mentally ill. I'm just astounded by the number of female offenders who are coming in with mental problems, Mr. Small said. He added that it's difficult to envision much improvement given the number of mentally ill street people who commit crimes just to survive, often unaware they are breaking the law. The federal penitentiary system is no better off. They are really struggling, said Dr. Bradford. Despite everything we have done in the forensic system and health systems, growth continues at a rate of 5 to 10% a year. A glut of psychiatric offenders was underlined recently by a string of recent orders from Toronto judges for hospital officials to stop shunting unfit offenders to provincial jails. With hospital and jail officials locked in battle over who will house them, police have been forced to warehouse them in holding cells. Graham Glancy, a forensic psychiatrist at Maplehurst Correctional Facility, said a new problem is emerging in the jail system: developmentally handicapped or low-intelligence inmates. They are very vulnerable. Some of them can be annoying. There is so little stimulation for them in the jails that they have temper tantrums, and if they do, it is going to get them hurt. Almost 30% of the jail population is comprised of the developmentally handicapped, inmates with psychiatric disorders or serious drug and alcohol problems, Mr. Wright said. That in the Globe and Mail by Kirk Macon, Justice Reporter. And front page news, wait time problem continues to fester. The recent death of a Montreal woman after waiting 6 hours in a hospital emergency ward and a crisis summit of experts in Alberta is highlighting renewed anxiety throughout the country about emergency backlogs. Therese de Repentigny, 78, had still not been seen by a doctor for her pain-related complaints when she tried to climb off a gurney to go to the washroom and collapsed. Medical staff finally rushed to her aid, but it was too late, her family said. Within moments, they said, she was dead. No one came, a tearful Fernande Blais, the woman's daughter, told his local CTV station. The entire night was spent that way. A Quebec patients group said Wednesday that such waits are anything but uncommon. Alberta physicians have said overcrowding is setting the stage for a catastrophic collapse. Police in Manitoba began a criminal investigation last month into the death of a disabled man who died in a Winnipeg emergency room following a wait of 34 hours. Critics allege many governments have let the ERQs linger as they tried to address other wait times that were given higher priority. That by Tom Blackwell on the front page of the National Post. And in the same post, Friday, November 19th. Patients dying due to long ER delays. Study. Critically ill often leave ward after excessive waiting. Emergency ward patients are enduring prolonged suffering, deterioration, and even death in Alberta hospitals because of delays in their diagnosis and treatment, according to an internal report to the province's health authority. The report, written by Dr. Grant Innes of Alberta Health Services and leaked to the provincial opposition Wild Rose Alliance, documents 11 cases, including 5 deaths, in which patients were left in waiting rooms or hallways. They happened in the last 2 to 3 years. Almost all of them were in Alberta, and most were in Calgary, Dr. Innes said. In one case, a patient with chest pain suffered a heart attack and died because he wasn't seen promptly and given proper drugs. In a second, a person with a sore stomach died of an aortic rupture before being diagnosed. In another instance, a patient with a sore limb who was not seen promptly ended up with a severe infection that resulted in amputation. At the root of the problem, the report says, is the dramatic rise in the number of acute care beds that are unavailable for emergency patients because they are blocked by patients who should be in other facilities. To ease the problem, Dr. Innes proposed that when emergency wards become overcrowded, the most stable patients should be sent on a no-refusal basis to other wards in the hospital, even if they too are already full. He also proposed moving stable seniors who no longer need acute care into waiting rooms or lounges at continuing care facilities. The report documents a chronic problem of seriously ill patients who leave emergency wards without ever being seen by a physician because they grow weary of waiting. Dr. Innes said some end up coming back in an ambulance, critically ill. Alberta's parliamentary assistant for health put much of the blame on his own government. In a leaked email on Wednesday, Dr. Raj Sherman, an Edmonton MLA who also works as an ER doctor, said his trust in the premier and cabinet was severely tarnished by broken promises to fix the crisis in emergency rooms. And now a little musical relief, Lucy Kaplansky, Song for Molly.
Now I'm in down a thousand trails. I never was.
brace for shock on hydro bills. Green energy policies, system upgrades will drive rates up 46% over 5 years, province warns. Ontarians will be zapped with a 46% increase in home electricity costs over the next 5 years to pay for much-needed hydro system upgrades, warns the Liberal government. Premier Dalton McGuinty's administration is offering a 10% discount on hydro bills starting in January and lasting 5 years. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan said electricity prices would still rise about 3.6% annually on an average bill after inflation and the new measure. The rise would have been 7.9% without the new benefit. He told the legislature rates should stabilize after 5 years once more expensive renewable energy sources replace heavily polluting coal-fired power plants. Duncan conceded the Liberals' green energy policies account for 56% of the skyrocketing prices, with expansion of nuclear and national gas power plants the reason for the remaining 44%. We are all paying for decades of neglect by governments of all political stripes. We had to invest. Duncan added, any politician who suggests, implies, or tries to tell people that the price of electricity is going to go down over the next 5 years is simply not telling the truth. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Hudak would not scrap the discount, nor could he say how much hydro rates would increase if he is elected in next fall's provincial vote. Duncan projected a deficit of $18.7 billion this fiscal year. That's down $1.7 billion from a previous forecast because of stronger economic growth, boosting expected revenues by almost $800 million to $107.7 billion. Despite his boast that 75% of jobs lost in the recession have been regained, revenue from personal income taxes is expected to be $1.13 billion below this year's forecast. That from the Toronto Star, Robert Benzie and Rob Ferguson from the Queen's Park Bureau. And depending on your sense of humor, a funny thing happened on the way to energy modernization. Energy Minister blames meters for pricey spike in hydro bills. Old models not billing properly as new smart meters are installed. Old electricity meters being replaced with new smart meters are partly to blame for the rising cost of power in some Ontario homes, says Energy Minister Brad Duguid. Duguid said that the old-style meters were 40 to 50 years old in some cases and not as accurate as the new ones. I'm not suggesting that bills haven't gone up, but there are a variety of reasons, he said. Smart meters are being installed as the system is modernized and as the government makes new investments in electricity generation to replace old coal-fired plants, another factor Duguid blames for rising bills. New Democrat leader Andrea Horvath said this is the first time she'd heard the old meter explanation for the jump in electricity costs. Every day it's a new story from the minister, she said, repeating her call for the government to remove the 8% provincial portion of the new harmonized sales tax from hydro bills. The HST is salt in the wound to hydro costs. Just take the HST off hydro and start giving people a break, she said. That by Rob Ferguson from the Queen's Park Bureau in Tuesday, November 16th's Toronto Star. Ontario's power trip, the high cost of conservation. In June 2006, Dwight Duncan was about to launch the Conservation Demand Management Program. The objective was to get Ontario consumers to reduce their peak demand for electricity by conservation. The first phase of that long-range plan from 2007 to 2010 recently ended with costs well above budget. Today, Mr. Duncan's directive and others since are set over time to cost Ontario electricity consumers as much as $2 billion in rate increases. The burden of these costs, along with others for green energy prices, solar power, and major transmission infrastructure, is now beginning to appear on consumer bills, promoting a political backlash that the Ontario government is now trying to turn back. But it turns out that saving money via demand reduction apparently costs a lot of money. Each corporation in the Ontario electricity chain incurred costs setting up the program. Toronto Hydro spent $60 million from 2007 to 2010. To get that money back, it sent a bill to the Ontario Power Authority. In all across the province, the bills mounted as the promotion campaign and other costs mounted. For 2010, the Ontario Power Authority budgeted $286.6 million for conservation demand management. Although the Ontario Power Authority's recently filed 2011 budget now estimates that they will spend $361.1 million for 2010. But costs for promotion are only part of the cost. Toronto Hydro, Hydro One, and all the other electricity distributors in the Ontario system claim to have lost revenue as a result of these programs. These deteriorated revenues, apparently the result of conservation, are losses they are now seeking to replace via rate increases. Toronto Hydro has applied for an 18.2% increase for 2011, or $448 million. Based on 2009 revenue. Hydro One, the province-wide transmission company, has applied for a 15.7% increase, or $555 million, based on their 2009 distribution revenues. But there is more to come. The Energy Minister, Brad Duguid, issued a fresh directive last March setting out the new short-term targets, officially called 2011 to 2014 Net Annual Peak Demand Savings Target. It effectively orders Ontario's 80 local companies to achieve peak demand savings of 1330 megawatts by 2014. Toronto Hydro will likely seek to recover revenue of as much as $338 million in 2014, equal to a rate increase of 13% of current revenues. Hydro One will likely seek to recover lost revenue of $328 million, or 9.3% of current distribution revenue. Those rate increases are just for the lost revenue portion of conservation demand management, which come on top of the marketing costs that are still to come. Then there are the subsidies for solar and wind generators that will be adding up by 2014. Ontario could be looking at 35% to 40% power rate hikes on top of the average 20% experienced this year, plus the 15% to 18% increases that Toronto Hydro and Hydro One are currently seeking. That from the National Post by Parker Gallant. Ontario to bribe its power-shocked voters. Ontario electricity prices, already up 30% since 2003, are set to rocket over the next few years, propelled by green energy policies. One forecast said the new policies mean price increases that will leave consumers paying 135% more for power in 2015 than in 2003. So now the government, having launched an industrial policy disaster, is going to try to con consumer voters by launching a tax policy disaster. The government will pay consumers a small amount of money to offset some of the large sums of money the government is forcing consumers to pay for its green energy regime. Meanwhile, Parker Gallant, in one of the Ontario's Power Trip reports, highlights the results of another of Mr. Duncan's early energy adventures. His 2006 peak demand management scheme is shaping up to be a $2 billion burden on taxpayers. Energy consultant Tom Adams, in a blog posting, reminded Ontario voters that when Mr. Duncan was energy minister in the first McGuinty cabinet after the 2003 election, he committed to a series of principles. Ratepayers, not taxpayers, must pay electricity costs. Consumers must pay the real costs of electricity. Ontario needs a culture of conservation policy. Electricity policy must be depoliticized. Mr. Adams suggests that instead of leading Ontario deeper into political woods on electricity policy, Mr. Duncan should resign. That won't happen, of course, even though all four of Mr. Duncan's principles have been thrown out and replaced with the exact opposite. Red flag raised on McGuinty's green policy. More from Adam Radwanski. The premier's decision to offer a hydro rate cut as part of his government's fall economic update is an admission of failure. It may prove more costly for the province at large, even for other provinces, if its lessons are heeded, than it does for Mr. McGuinty's Liberals. It's costly, for one thing, in a practical bottom-line sense. Since 2 years ago, the annual cost of servicing Ontario's debt has gone up by $1.4 billion. Adding an extra $1 billion or more to that debt each year to subsidize lower energy prices is not necessarily a service to taxpayers. It's also costly in another bigger picture way. Creating artificially lower energy prices confirms that the Liberals have all but thrown in the towel, at least for now, on a reasonably noble attempt at an adult conversation about the sacrifices required to shape a modern electricity grid and build a greener economy. Much effort was expended on extolling the virtues of green energy, which has very little to do with price increases to date. There was much less attempt until recently to explain more practical benefits, like avoiding blackouts or really high prices later. In fairness, unlike Ernie Eves, who imposed a retroactive rate freeze 6 months after deregulating the industry, McGuinty hasn't completely blown up his energy policy. The system won't be thrown into total chaos. The Liberals will join their opponents in pretending it's possible to pay less and get more. At least until the election next year. And the next government, whatever its stripe, will either have to continue that charade or further fracture the public trust by imposing a rate hike that nobody will dare acknowledge as a possibility during the campaign. And that in Adam Radwanski's Globe and Mail column, Thursday, November 18th. Off-peak electricity rates to start earlier. Starting next May, you won't have to wait until 9 p.m. to do your laundry. Government sources say off-peak electricity rates in Ontario will begin 2 hours earlier, 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. A senior government source said this will help families with an additional 2 hours in the evening to benefit from lower rates or an extra 10 hours a week. This is in addition to the new clean energy benefit, which will provide families with 10% off their electricity bills every month for 5 years. Ontario Energy Minister Brad Duguid was expected to make the announcement Tuesday. If it helps people actually save money, then I'm for it. But the bottom line is this government's in a scramble, Ontario NDP leader Andrea Horvath said Sunday. They don't know what they're doing one day to the next, and they're trying all kinds of different things to try to regain some confidence with the public. John Jakubowski, energy critic for the Progressive Conservative Party, said the announcement will be cold comfort to those who are going to suffer through time-of-use pricing this winter. And in the good news this week, you've been waiting for this one. Your flab may be useful after all. Two research teams reported the results from clinical trials in which heart patients were treated with stem cells derived from their own fat. Many scientists have great hopes for stem cells. In theory, at least, they could be used to fix diseased organs. But the work has been highly controversial because the best source of stem cells is human embryos. So scientists have been trying to isolate a sufficient supply of stem cells from the tissues of adults. And based on the new research released this week, it now appears that fat could be a viable option. The findings were presented in Chicago at the annual meeting of the American Heart Association. One trial led by Emerson Perrin of the Texas Heart Institute in Houston involved 27 patients who could barely function because they suffered from advanced heart disease. The other trial led by Enriquez Duckers, of Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam included 14 patients who had just experienced massive heart attacks. In the case of the heart attack patients, the amount of damage or scarred heart muscle shrank substantially within 6 months of treatment. So how do adult stem cells help repair an injured heart? Dr. Perrin said they are not as versatile as embryonic stem cells, which can morph into any tissue type. But these produce dozens of different proteins, reacting with other tissues and making things grow, he said. For instance, some of them turn into new blood vessels that increase the supply of blood flowing to the oxygen-starved heart muscle. The medical procedure provides a big boost to the repair process by delivering a huge number of cells to the site of injury. Dr. Duckers is already making plans for a large international trial that will likely include Canadian medical centers in Toronto and Montreal. Working on the assumption that more is better, he hopes to inject damaged hearts with a greater number of stem cells than in the initial trial. And that's all the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. You know we will have more. And to take us out, a singer with an unearthly voice, Lucy Kaplansky, Somebody's Home. Wherever you're near an internet download, Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.